Translation. Thus, established in the mode of unalloyed goodness, the man whose mind has been enlivened by the contact with devotional service to the Lord gains positive scientific knowledge of the personality of Godhead in the stage of liberation from all material association. Okay, so this is the purport by His Divine Grace, A.C. Srila Bhaktivedanta Prabhupada Ki. Okay, so it's a bit of a lengthy purport, so pay attention. In the Bhagavad Gita 7.3, it is said that out of many thousands of ordinary men, one fortunate man endeavors for perfection in life. Mostly men are conducted by the modes of passion and ignorance. Thus, they are engaged always in lust, desire, hankering, ignorance, and sleep. Out of many such man-like animals, there is actually a man who knows the responsibility of human life and thus tries to make life perfect by following the prescribed duties. Out of many thousands of such persons who have thus attained success in human life, one may know scientifically about the personality of Godhead Sri Krishna. In the same Bhagavad Gita, 1855, it is also said that scientific knowledge of Sri Krishna is understood only by the process of devotional service, Bhakti Yoga. The very same thing is confirmed herein in the above words. No ordinary man, or even one who has attained success in human life, can know scientifically or perfectly the personality of Godhead. Perfection of human life is attained when one can understand that he is not the product of matter, but is in fact spirit. And as soon as one understands that he has nothing to do with matter, he at once ceases his material hankerings and becomes enlivened as a spiritual being. This attainment of success is possible when one is above the modes of passion and ignorance, or in other words, when one is actually a Brahmana by qualifications. A Brahmana is the symbol of Sattva-guna, or the mode of goodness. And others who are not in the mode of goodness are either Kshatriyas, Vaishyas, Sudras, or less than the Sudras. The Brahmanical stage is the highest stage of human life because it's good qualities. So one cannot be a devotee unless one is at least qualifies as a Brahmana. The devotee is already a Brahmana by action, but that is not the end of it. As referred to above, such a Brahmana has to become a Vaishnava, in fact, to be actually in the transcendental stage. A pure Vaishnava is liberated soul and is even a Brahmana. In the material stage, even a Brahmana is also a conditioned soul, because although in the Brahminical stage, the conception of Brahman or transcendence is realized, scientific knowledge of the Supreme Lord is lacking. One has to surpass the Brahminical stage and reach the Vasudev stage to understand the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Krishna. The science of the personality of Godhead is the subject matter for study by the postgraduate students in the spiritual line. Foolish men, or men with poor fund of knowledge, do not understand the Supreme Lord, and they interpret Krishna according to their respective whims. The fact is, however, that one cannot understand the science of personality of Godhead unless one is freed from the contamination of the material modes, even up to the stage of a Brahmana. When a qualified Brahmana factually becomes a Vaishnava, in the enlivened state of liberation, he can know what is actually the personality of Godhead. Om Ajnana Tirimandasya Gananjana Shalakaya Chakshurum Militam Yena Tasmai Shri Guruve Namaha Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhara Shri Vasadi Gaura Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Okay, so one more time, reading the translation. Thus established in the mode of unalloyed goodness, the man whose mind has been enlivened by contact with devotional service to the Lord gains positive scientific knowledge of the personality of Godhead in the stage of liberation from all material association. Okay, Hare Krishna everyone. Hope you're well. So first of all, I'd like to seek the blessings of the devotees present here today, that I can speak something which can help people advance in their spiritual life, of course. So obviously, I'm not Radhavala Prabhu, because Radhavala Prabhu unfortunately had another service, so they had to find a backup speaker. So I was a messenger of finding a new speaker. But generally, in Krishna consciousness, the messenger ends up doing the task himself. So hence, I'm here. But I'm very grateful because I got an opportunity to dissect this purport, this section of the Bhagavatam, which is very important, is very amazing. And so I got a lot out of it, and I'm hoping to share that with everyone here as well. So today we're reading chapter Canto 1, second chapter, verse number 20. And this is a very fascinating purport, actually. A lot of wisdom is presented in this purport. So first of all, I want to dissect the translation. Very interesting. It gives you a very wonderful formula into how we can know and understand the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So we're all here trying to understand God. We're trying to, you know, comprehend, see God. But here, in this purport, it gives you the formula of how we can actually see God using scientific knowledge. So it's mentioned that when one is in the mode of pure goodness, so we have the three modes of material nature, you have passion, ignorance, and goodness, but above goodness, there is something called pure goodness. When one actually functions in pure goodness, one is actually rejuvenated by bhakti. So it becomes a very joyful process. And then it says one becomes liberated from the three modes, which is the one that's controlling us. And at the same time, the scientific knowledge gets revealed to the individual from within, by which we can understand the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So I was just thinking, maybe what we could do is we can break up this section of the Bhagavatam. So we've just started reading Bhagavatam again. This is the second chapter. So in the first chapter, we hear the glories of Srimad Bhagavatam. We hear that the sages, right? The sages have gathered in the forest. Does anyone know which forest the sages gathered in? Naimisharanya. So this is a very holy place. And in back of the days, the sages only had one primary duty or purpose in life. What do you think the purpose of the sages was back in the days? What was that? Yeah, the sages did not care about their personal well-being or anything like that. Their prime duty or responsibility was to do welfare activities for the humanity in the future. Sages were actually known as Trikalya Gyan, which means they knew the past, they knew the present, and they knew the future. So in the meditation, the sages could foresee that in the future, the condition or the situation is not going to be so great for people. In Kali Yuga, it says that we live a very short life, we're very disturbed, we're prone to illusion, we're prone to making mistakes. So the situation is not exactly the best to make spiritual advancement. So what the sages do is that they start performing 1,000-year yagya or sacrifice for the benefit of society. And it is here that there is a great discussion that takes place. So this discussion is actually facilitated by a personality called Shonaka Rishi, and he's been questioned by the representative of all the sages called Suta Goswami. So in the first chapter we see that the sages ask Shonaka Rishi six important questions about life. And then you'll see that the whole Bhagavatam, the 12th canto, is actually expansion of the answers to these six questions. Now, chapter 2, which is what we started now, we'll see that Shonaka Rishi now starts answering some of these six questions. And this is the section of Bhagavatam, the second chapter, where there are five key verses which actually explains the glories of hearing Bhagavatam and also explains how the heart can be purified. So the five verses is from verse 17 to 21, which verse 20 is what we're going to speak about today. So today's verse purport is quite long, but it has so much detail, wisdom and information that we can extract. And it's interesting, I was doing book distribution a few years ago, and I was speaking to one person, trying to give him a book, and then the person, well, he was very skeptical. So he was telling me that, you know, my religion is the best, because all, what you're doing is all bogus, this is all bogus and it's not genuine. He goes, my religion is the best because there is so many people following my tradition. So his logic was that because you have masses of people following a tradition means that's the correct religion. Now, does that logically make sense? Does majority equate to the right thing? Why not? Why is it? You know, sometimes people think, oh, you know, a lot of people are following a particular process, so it must be the right thing, isn't it? Well, that actually, then I got bewildered on the street, because you're doing books, you're already on a mental platform, and then when he told me that, I was like, oh yeah, we don't see so many people following Krishna consciousness. So does that mean this process doesn't work? And then after contemplating, I thought the argument that this gentleman was presenting was so illogical. Just because majorities of people follow something doesn't mean it's the right thing. Because based on that logic, that means that whatever Hitler did, it was correct, because majority of people followed his regime, you know? Whatever, so majority people does not equate to the right thing. So here, beginning of the purport is explained that why is it that only few people take up to Krishna consciousness? It's the highest philosophy, right? It's the highest philosophy. It's what everyone's looking for. But yet, why is it that not many people take up to Krishna consciousness? Any idea? They have material desires? Okay, so what? What's the problem? If we have material desires, what's the problem? We're rational beings. We're prone to mistakes, all this stuff. That's fine. But still, Krishna consciousness will help you to overcome this. But still, why isn't that people? There's a clue in the beginning of the purport. Yes. And how do we come to the human platform? Good. Basically, Prabhupada actually in this purport starts off with a verse in the Gita. Did anyone notice or pick it up? Sorry? 7.3. Manusyanam sahasreshu. Now this is a very powerful verse from the Bhagavad Gita. Krishna says that out of thousands of men, one will achieve perfection. And out of thousands of people who have achieved perfection, one will hardly know Krishna in truth. So this shows that Krishna conscious process is very rare. Okay, not many people will get up to it or can take up to it. And actually it is here, which most of you actually said, that the reason why people can't take up to Krishna consciousness is because their life revolves around mode of passion and mode of ignorance. When our life revolves around mode of passion and ignorance, it means our activity is based on lust, desire, which is never ending. So we're always hankering. And because of this, we're prone to illusion and sleep. These are the prominent symptoms of those who function in the mode of passion and ignorance. So it is only when one functions in the mode of goodness does one achieve perfection. Now, what does Prabhupada say in this purport, if anyone noticed? What is perfection? How did he define perfection? What is perfection in this purport? We all want to achieve perfection, but what does that mean? Yes. Free from material desires. Okay. Yeah, yeah. See, Krishna consciousness is interesting because there's more than one answer, isn't it? And you can justify anything by saying whatever. But it actually here is interesting. Prabhupada specifically mentions exactly what it means of perfection. What does perfection actually mean? Jagat Priyamaji? Even before that, you can achieve perfection before coming to devotional service. Yeah, but what does it mean to even just have perfection, even before that? Prabhupada writes something very interesting in the purport. What is perfection? Good. That is. So sometimes you don't have to even take up to bhakti to achieve perfection. You know, because perfection of, it says perfection here is to understand that we are not the product of matter, rather we're a product of spirit. So we're not this material body, we're this spirit soul. And only then you come to perfection. But even when you come to this stage, doesn't mean that you'll understand Krishna. Because when you're in mode of goodness, you will understand that you're different from material or matter. Then mode of goodness is like a springboard where you can actually jump to pure goodness. So it's mentioned that only in the platform of pure goodness can we understand and reap the benefits of bhakti. Does that make sense? You know, so that's what the essence of the purport was, that if you want to understand God, if you want to understand Krishna, then you have to come to the stage of pure goodness. But we can't come to a stage of pure goodness until we actually come to the stage of goodness, right? So if we're in passion ignorance, we have to cultivate and readjust our lifestyle so we can get to pure mode of goodness, and then from there we can get to pure goodness. I was also hearing a class from Prabhupada on this verse, in this purport, and also very interesting stuff that Srila Prabhupada actually speaks about here. So this is a class that he gave in October 31st, 1972 in Vrindavan. And Prabhupada explains that actually to know Krishna, to know God or absolute truth, it is not a sentimental thing, emotional thing. A lot of times people think religion actually means that, oh, it's a sentimental thing, it's about feeling. But that's not the case. This is a very advanced scientific process by which we can understand God or Krishna. So it's mentioned, who can understand Krishna? So Prabhupada explains that those who are free from the three modes of material nature, can you actually understand God? And then Prabhupada, first thing he does, he defines what is God. So if someone asks you, what is the definition of God, what would you say? How would you define God? If someone just says that, I'm God, like how do you actually make sure that, you know, is this person God? What's the definition of God? Sorry? Yeah, that's basically one of the main definition of God, that God actually means one who's a controller. But it's very interesting. Prabhupada here also says that to some extent, we are also God. Ooh, controversial, huh? He says that we're also God. Why do you think he said that? We also have controlling powers. We like to control things. And that's why he says to some extent, we are also the controller. Because Prabhupada said, we also to some extent God. So then he actually explains that actually Krishna is the supreme, he is God, because supreme controller means someone that no one controls. So Krishna is someone that no one controls him. He's a controller. So that's why he is known as God. Whereas the living entities, are we always in control? No? Sometimes we think we are. But who are we always controlled by? The modes of material nature. We're always, no matter when we think we're in control, it's actually the modes that's actually controlling us. And therefore, it's mentioned that until we are under the modes, we can never understand God fully. So we have to get out of it. And that's the reason why bhakti yoga or devotional service, it's a process by which we can actually understand God. So now the question arises that when we perform bhakti yoga, we are no longer controlled by God, by the modes of material nature. We're free from it. So does that mean we also become the controller? No, then who do we get controlled by? By Krishna. So we're always under control. So the choice that we have is, who do we want to be controlled by? Do we want to be controlled by the modes of material nature, which is temporary, limited, or do we want to be controlled by Krishna through his Yogamaya potency. That choice we have. So now the question arises, Prabhupada here explains very nicely that what is the test to see that we are properly engaged in devotional service? How do we know that we're sometimes devotional service can be very mechanical. I don't know if you've experienced it, but sometimes, you know, I'd chant because I have to chant my rounds. I'd read because, you know, I may have to give a class or whatever. But how do we know we are actually performing devotional service properly? You're satisfied? Okay. You're happy? Yeah, basically that's the trick. That's the test. Prabhupada explains that when you perform bhakti yoga, one of the symptoms is that you're joyful. That's what it says here, that when we engage in devotional service, we're rejuvenated by bhakti. So if you're happy, that means you are actually engaging in devotional service properly. But is that always the case? Sometimes we kind of... Radha Govinda actually told me that he once saw a t-shirt. And the t-shirt said, chant and be happy. But then at the bottom he goes, at least chant. You know, so sometimes we chant and not necessarily experience the happiness. But Prabhupada explains that actually that's because you know that you're being attacked by Maya. Because when you're connecting with Krishna, you're always joyous. You can never be morose or sad. But when we engage in devotional service and we see that we're not happy, that's because we can understand that we're being attacked by Maya Devi. You know, so that's the test to know. So now the question arises that why is it that we do not actually experience full happiness in Krishna consciousness? We're unsteady, but why? What's controlling us? The mind is controlling us. Okay. But who's controlling the mind? Who's controlling the mind? Aniruddha, okay, in the literal sense, sure. To understand why we can't actually experience real happiness when we're engaging in Krishna consciousness, we have to go back and understand Jai Shishi Radha Gokulananda ki, Sita Ram Lakshman Hanuman ki, Gaur Nitai ki, Jai. So to understand why is it that when we engage in bhakti yoga we don't experience joyfulness is because we have to understand and we have to go back to the time of creation. Now, who created the material world? Krishna, of course, he's the primary creator. Who did he empower to do the secondary creation? Lord Brahma. Now, do you know what's the first thing Lord Brahma created? Huh? No, even before any creation started, before the creation of the living entities, the first thing Brahma created was what? Yes. Actually, this is from third canto, which is describing, in the 12th chapter, it's describing the creation of Lord Brahma. And this is a translation, which is very interesting. It says, Brahma first created the nescient engagements of the self, like self-deception, the sense of death, anger after frustration, and the sense of false ownership, and the illusory bodily concept, or forgetfulness of one's identity. So this is quite bewildering. Why on earth would Brahma create ignorance first? That's the first thing he created. Why? What sort of a creation is that? That? Yeah. Absolutely. It's mentioned that he was not proud of his first creation. When Brahma first created ignorance, he felt very disgusted. So it's mentioned that before the factual creation of the living entities in different varieties of species, the conditions under which a living being in the material world has to live were created by Brahma, and that was ignorance. So we came in the material world because we wanted to enjoy without Krishna. Now, in order for us to do that, we have to forget about Krishna. And that's the reason why Brahma first created ignorance. It is because of ignorance that we start identifying ourselves with matter. We start trying to think that material world will give me happiness. So it's very interesting. Ignorance has deeper layers. It says that there are five layers of how ignorance actually work. So it says that first thing is, the first condition of material existence is when we're under ignorance is that we forget our real identity. Okay, when we come in the material world, we forget who we are. And this is what is called spiritual amnesia. We suffer from spiritual amnesia. We've forgotten our true identity. And this was necessary in order for us, it says, unless a living entity forgets his real identity, it's impossible for us to live in the material condition of life. Now what's the next step? Once we forget our identity, it says that the living entity begins to misidentify oneself with material nature. So we now start identifying with this body, we start identifying with modes of material nature. Now you can see how we're becoming quite deeply entangled in this illusory energy of the Lord. It doesn't stop there. So first, we forget our identity. Second, we start identifying things with matter, which is completely contradictory to our nature. The third thing is, then we start developing false sense of ownership in this world. So we start thinking we're the proprietor. We start thinking we're the controllers. So this is known as Mahamoha, which means that that's even greater illusion. And when this happens, what happens is that whenever there is any obstacle or obstruction for our enjoyment of the material world, this gives rise to anger. So that's the fourth stage, the fourth layer of ignorance. And therefore, because of all this conditioning, it says that's why in this world is a great struggle for existence, because of it's based on four primary activities. In the material, we all function on four things. Every single living entity, their activity is based on four things. What are those four things? Yes, eating, sleeping, mating, and defending. And out of these four things, which is the one we spend most of our time on? No. No, it's not. It's actually fear, defending, you know? It says that most of our time is spent on defending and fear. We're always fear of many things. When we leave the house, you know, what are we fear of? No, as in when we leave the house, what do you do to your house? You lock it. Why? You're afraid that someone will break in. So actually it's mentioned that most of the time that we spend our time and energy on is defending. So it says that the aspect of fear is where we spend most of our time on. And so therefore the final layer of ignorance is that our fear of death. You know? So these are the five layers of ignorance. And because of this entanglement of illusion and ignorance, it's difficult for us to actually relish the process of bhakti yoga. Now this is very interesting. So what's the solution? Okay, Brahma created illusion. Didn't make sense. His goal was to get everyone back to Godhead in the spiritual world, but he's actually created something which entangles people more. So what do you think Brahma did next? How does one get out of ignorance? What is needed to counteract ignorance? Knowledge. Exactly. So the next verse, very interesting. Brahma felt disgusted by this necessary act. So what did he do to resolve this, to counteract ignorance? He basically created knowledge. Okay, so he says, although Brahma created the principles of nescience as a matter of necessity for those living entities who were destined to ignorance by the will of Lord, he was not satisfied in performing such a thankless task. Okay, he therefore created four principles of knowledge. And you know who was in charge of those four principles of knowledge? Who were the first created being? Manus, no, even before then. Four Kumaras, yeah. Four Kumaras were who Lord Brahma created, and Lord Brahma actually created four principles of knowledge. The first one was Sankhya philosophy. It's called the empirical philosophy of the analytical study of material condition. He gave that in charge to one of the four Kumaras. The second principle of knowledge was yoga or mysticism for liberation. So this is a process or knowledge which can help you get out of the material bondage. The third principle of knowledge was vairagya, or acceptance of complete detachment from material enjoyment in life and elevating oneself to the highest spiritual understanding. And the fourth and last but not least aspect or principle of knowledge was tapas, or voluntary austerities performed for spiritual perfection. And that's the reason why these four great sages, Sanaka, Sananda, Sanatan, and Sanat, were to entrust them with these four principles. And that's why at the end, we have four sampradayas, and they're one of them who belong to Nimbarka sampradaya. You know? So then Lord Brahma created knowledge. Now, when we read Bhagavatam, can you understand everything? It's very difficult. It says actually it's impossible to understand Krishna. You know, it says that Anantashesh, he has thousands of mouths because he's got so many hoods. He glorifies Krishna. And even with all those mouths when he's glorifying Krishna, it's injustice. He can only describe a very small portion of Krishna's glories. So once somebody asked Prabhupada that, why did you write all these books if ultimately you cannot understand Krishna anyways? We have so many books we have to read. You've got the Gita, then you've got Bhagavatam, then you've got Chaitanya Charitamrita. You're reading books to understand Krishna, but you can never understand Krishna. So what's the point? Someone asked this to Prabhupada. So Prabhupada said that I wrote these to convince you that he can never be understood. That's the whole point of writing these books, that you can never understand Krishna. Trying to understand Krishna is something like man standing on in front of Pacific Ocean, trying to estimate the volume. That's the analogy that Prabhupada gave. So only way you can understand Krishna is actually by Krishna's mercy. If Krishna is pleased with our endeavor, he will actually reveal the knowledge about Krishna to us. Also, another interesting story. One time a Mayavad complained to a devotee, why does your Prabhupada put Krishna everywhere? On one page he has written 10 times. And here even Krishna is not in the shloka, but Prabhupada has written Krishna. Because it's no good. This Mayavad philosophy was complaining to a devotee. So the devotee related this comment to Prabhupada. Prabhupada asked the devotee, how many times did he say Krishna? The devotee said, I've lost count. Prabhupada said, this is why I have written Krishna everywhere, so I can trick even rascals like this. You know? So every time that you hear, read about Krishna, you can actually... the person gets purified and they can actually come to the stage of transcendental pure goodness. So that's why knowledge is very, very powerful. And it's mentioned that only through knowledge can we actually understand Krishna. And through knowledge we can gain or understand and experience the process of real bhakti. Now, one of the things about knowledge is that one of the qualities we need to dissect knowledge or understand knowledge is enthusiasm. Rupa Goswami writes in Nectar of Instruction that enthusiasm is one of the qualities we need to become successful in our spiritual practice. And there's a very fascinating story that relates to this. That it's of Hanuman. Now, when Hanuman was young, he was a baby, he used to become very hungry, so he wanted to eat everything. Babies or kids are very inquisitive. So once, what did he try to swallow? He tried to swallow the sun. He saw, what is this big red fruit? He thought it was a fruit. So he tried to actually swallow the fruit, thinking it was a fruit. So he swallows the whole sun. So that's the first time Lord Hanuman actually approached the sun. So Hanuman wanted to approach the sun again, second time. So Suryadev saw Hanuman approaching Lord Suryadev. He gets worried. He goes, last time when Hanuman actually approached me, he swallowed me. It was so embarrassing for me. So this time he gets quite bewildered. He goes, why is Hanuman coming to me today? But he was also shocked. He sees that Hanuman was approaching him with humility. And then when Hanuman actually came, he actually addressed to Suryadev. Hanuman said to Suryadev, that respective Suryadev, I have heard that you are the world's best teacher. Sages from all over the universe come to you for knowledge, to your school to receive education. So would you be kind enough to admit me into your school? I am very eager to gain knowledge. I am prepared to face all challenges and hurdles. Suryadev was actually very humbled. He goes, oh, Hanuman wants to learn from me. And so Suryadev was very flattered, and he was very happy to hear this. But he was in a dilemma. Even Suryadev has a school where there's admission you have to go through. And Suryadev said that, my dear Hanuman, I'd love for you to become my student, but unfortunately, the admission is completely full. I have no more space for any students to take on. So then Hanuman goes, oh, that's not a problem. So Surya Dev's classroom is actually his chariot. This is where all the students reside, and this is where they all learn the Vedic knowledge. So it's mentioned that Hanuman was so eager to learn that he would stand or wait outside the classroom and hear everything Surya Dev was teaching to his students. Even when the Surya Dev was moving, orbiting, Hanuman would fly and listen. It's mentioned that he was so attentive that Surya Dev did not have to repeat single time what he was teaching. So it says that within 60 orbits of the sun, Hanuman studied all the Vedas proficiently. He knew all the Vedas, you know, and Surya Dev was very pleased. Hanuman was very happy that he got all this knowledge. And then Hanuman said that, my dear teacher, I am very, thank you very much for giving me this knowledge, and I want to offer you Guru Dakshina. You know, like you have to offer something back to the teacher to reciprocate with the knowledge he's given. So then Hanuman actually, then Surudev said that I have only one request. He said that my son, who's Sugriva, he's actually struggling because he's been bereft of all his opulence and family because of his brother Bali. And therefore, I want you to become his minister and protect him. And this is why Hanuman becomes a minister of Sugriva. So this is a very interesting lesson, how because Hanuman was so eager, because of his enthusiasm and eagerness, he could assimilate even difficult wisdom. And that's what's also required even for us to actually understand transcendental knowledge. So that's all I wanted to actually share with everyone. We spoke about how we can, only in mode of pure goodness, can we actually relish the process and the benefits of bhakti. And the best way to come to pure, in the mode of pure goodness, is through knowledge. By reading, by hearing, by attending Bhagavatam classes, the heart gets purified, we elevate the modes, and eventually we come to the platform of pure goodness. Great, that's all I had to say. I don't know if anyone has any questions or comments.